The title of this talk is The Entrepreneurial Vocation. And that phrase comes from Father Robert Sirico's speeches in the early years of Acton Institute. It was eventually turned into essays and videos to describe the holy calling and the mission of a business person. He wrote, "The time has come for religious institutions and leaders to treat entrepreneurship as a worthy vocation, indeed as a sacred calling. All lay people have a special role to play in the economy of salvation, sharing in the task of furthering the faith by using their talents in complementary ways. Every person created in God's image has been given certain natural ability that God desires to be cultivated and treated as good gifts. If the gift happens to be an inclination for business, stock trading, or investment banking, the religious community should not condemn the person merely on account of his or her profession." Why do you have to say that in the early 1990s? Because the reality was entrepreneurs as a class were in many places at best tolerated and often calumniated. The images of businessmen in literature, academia, Hollywood, and the news were generally negative. Charles Dickens portrayed Ebenezer Scrooge before his conversion. Marx divided the world into two classes, the bourgeois exploiters and the exploited workers. Hollywood generally showed business people as greedy, exploitative, acquisitive, narcissistic, cutthroat, selfish, proud, and vicious. The news would feature white-collar criminals whose practices were illegal and immoral, who exhibited so many of the sins to which human beings are prone. If such images were true, no wonder why entrepreneurs had a bad rap. Coupled with the fact that we're all troubled by the problem of poverty, hear the cry of the poor when they're unjustly taken advantage of, and look for someone to blame, we had a very easy scapegoat. Beyond this, there was a particular animus in the way many Christian leaders, theologians, and educators approached the subject of money, and in particular, those who had earned or had earned a lot of it, based in particular on interpretations of words and events in sacred scripture, like Jesus' encounter with the rich young man and his words that it's easier for a camel to fit through the eye of a needle than for one who is rich to enter into God's kingdom. Jesus' declaration in the Sermon on the Plain, "Woe to you who are rich, you have received your consolation." Jesus' parable of the rich man and Lazarus, in which we see the rich man go to hell for his failure to care for the poor dying man hungry at his gates. Jesus' words when someone approached with an inheritance dispute, "Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life doesn't consist in the abundance of possessions." Jesus' warning about the sudden death of the man with a successful grain harvest, "You fool, so it is with those who store up for themselves treasures but are not rich toward God." Jesus' clear teaching on more than one occasion about how we cannot serve both God and mammon, giving us a clear choice that seems to be like the choice between Christ and Barabbas. Mary's words in her Magnificat, "God has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty." And St. Paul's sharp words to St. Timothy, "The love of money is the root of all evil." These and other sayings, which were clearly warning against the idolatry of money and material things, against placing our faith, hope, and love in the things of this world rather than the things of God, led to some treating those who had sought to make money in business seem like worshippers of the ancient golden calf, a bias that would often find its way into homilies and sermons, catechetical and Bible school lessons, and more. In those places where, in particular, there was a Marxist reading of liberation theology, such a bias was even more pronounced. Through the term and the theme of the entrepreneurial vocation, Father Sirico wanted to focus on the fundamental goodness of the material dimension of human existence, and the theology of work and the calling of the businessman, arguing that the creative aspect of the entrepreneur was akin to God's creative activity we see in the book of Genesis. Like the vocation of a parent in bearing and raising children, so an entrepreneur, albeit in a less sublime way, bring enterprises into birth and nurtures them to serve others' unmet needs, providing the opportunity for others to grow and support their families, helping so many grow through their fostering of their own vocation to work. We're no longer, thankfully, in the same situation where business leaders are ubiquitously disparaged. Many places have finally gotten off the most wanted list and occasionally onto Santa's good side. This is partially, we can say, because of the perseverance and persuasiveness of Father Sirico and the Acton Institute over these last 28 years. For Catholics, the change is clearly one of the implications of the Second Vatican Council's universal call to holiness, that business leaders are likewise called to be holy. And I like to argue that the recent popes have had a role in that change. St. John Paul II spoke persuasively about the role of the entrepreneur in an address to the entrepreneurs of Milan, the economic epicenter of Italy, in 1985. John Paul promoted the value of entrepreneurship as a social service. He said the degree of well-being that society enjoys today would have been impossible without the dynamic figure of the entrepreneur, whose function consists in organizing human labor and the means of production to produce goods and services. Pope Benedict authorized the then Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace to put out a beautiful document in May 2012 entitled The Vocation of the Business Leader, in which it forthrightly stated, "The vocation of the business person is a genuine human and Christian calling. Its importance in the life of the church and the world economy can hardly be overstated." Pope Francis has on several occasions called business a noble vocation and developed this idea in a speech before the U.S. Congress in September 2015. After acknowledging the fight against poverty, he said to senators and congressmen, "The fight against poverty and hunger must be fought constantly on many fronts, especially in its causes. I know that many Americans today, as in the past, are working to deal with this problem. It goes without saying that part of this great effort is the creation and distribution of wealth, the right use of natural resources, the proper application of technology, and the harnessing of the spirit of enterprise are essential elements of an economy that seeks to be modern, inclusive, and sustainable. Business is a noble vocation," he continued, "directed to producing wealth and improving the world. Can be a source of fruitful prosperity for the area in which it operates, especially if it sees the creation of jobs as an essential part of its service to the common good." Many, as a result of the way Pope Francis has decried what he thinks is a deification of the market and an obsession with profit, have thought that Pope Francis is anti-business and anti-entrepreneur. But the words that I just read to you are not of someone who always disparages business. He clarified his thoughts last May in Genoa when he distinguished between entrepreneurs and speculators. Probably a better way to say it is entrepreneurs and exploitative hedge fund managers. That's what he was getting at. He said the businessman is a key figure in any good economy. There's no good economy without a good entrepreneur. There's no good business without good entrepreneurs, without the ability to create jobs, to create products. A disease of the economy is the progressive transformation of entrepreneurs into speculators. The entrepreneur mustn't be confused with the speculator. When you hear speculator, think exploitative hedge fund manager. Speculation in English means a little something different than it would in Italian. Speculator doesn't love his company. He doesn't love his workers. He sees business and workers only as a means to make a profit. He uses the company and the workers solely to make a profit. Firing, closing down, moving the company isn't a problem for him because the speculator uses, exploits, eats people as means to reach profit targets. When the economy is inhabited by good entrepreneurs, businesses are friendly to people, even to the poor. When it falls into the hands of this type of speculation, though, everything's ruined. We must fear the speculators, not the entrepreneurs. No, don't fear businessmen because there are so many good ones. No, fear speculators. And he goes on. But that's where it comes from. Because, a little biographically for Pope Francis, when he was in Argentina, he met a lot of these exploitative entrepreneurs rather than ones who are trying to make it win-win-win. Well, the title of the entrepreneurial vocation is no longer controversial or borderline blasphemous in some circles. That doesn't mean it's well or deeply understood. That's what I'd like to do in today's lecture, to understand the call of the entrepreneur more profoundly from a theological and practical level, with the help of doing a few things. First, nourishing the understanding of those engaged in business so that they may live out their vocation more ardently. Second, assisting those in ministry or future ministry support better those in business and strengthen them to live out their vocation to the full. And help all of us to see that there's supposed to be an entrepreneurial dimension to every Christian vocation because God has implanted creative potential in all of us. This presentation will involve a few steps and parts. The universal call to holiness will be the first part, since the vocation of the entrepreneur must, like every Christian vocation, be understood within the more comprehensive call to be like Christ. Second, a theological discussion of the vocation of every person to work. Third, a specific theological focus within that discussion on the calling to work, on the specific vocation of the entrepreneur. And lastly, some practical considerations about how to live out this vocation faithfully. Let's begin with the vocation of every person to holiness. What's a vocation? It's a sacred calling from God. Often we think about the word calling in the context of the calling of the apostles from their boats or their money tables, or the calling of St. Paul from persecuting the early church. In other words, calling has to do with preaching the gospel primarily, leaving behind family, lands, occupations for the kingdom. These are real callings, but they're not the only ones. The fundamental vocation of every Christian has been received through baptism. It's the vocation to be holy. St. Paul wrote in his first letter to the Thessalonians, "This is God's will for you, your sanctification." Book of Leviticus, God said over and over again, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, "Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." That word, by the way, is teleos in Greek, which means be who you were created to be. Doesn't mean never, ever, 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 ever make a math mistake. It's not to create neuroses. It's to remind us of the purpose for which we were made. Just as one of these microphones is teleos if it actually does a good job of projecting my speech, just like this PowerPoint clicker is non-teleos because it doesn't want to work today very well. So we're teleoi when we take seriously our calling of, by the Lord to be holy as He is holy, to glorify Him, to grow in the gift of salvation and sanctification, and to become a means by which He can bring others to receive that same gift. Holiness is simply becoming more and more godlike. It involves a grace-filled growing in divine attributes so that the deepest source of our human identity, namely our capacity to image God and to be configured to Christ by the power of the Holy Spirit, is more and more manifest. Second thing is the vocation to work. There is a specific vocation to work that is the setting in which the vast majority of people in the middle of the world will achieve that vocation of holiness. In the words of St. John Paul II, holiness is not something outside the bounds of normal everyday life. For God calls His people to lead holy lives within the ordinary circumstances in which they find themselves, at home, in the parish, in the workplace, at school, on the playing field. Each one of us has received a vocation to work. The first command in the gospel, which we'll develop more below, was not what we call the first commandment of the Decalogue, but rather came right after God called us into existence. It was a calling to a threefold work: increase and multiply. fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the creatures of the earth. St. John Paul II, in his document on human work, Laborum Exercens, said, "We must go back to the fundamental issue of human work, which is of such importance for the human person. It constitutes one of the fundamental dimensions of his earthly existence and of his vocation." And 10 years later, in Centesimus Annus, he said, "Work belongs to the vocation of every person. Indeed, man expresses and fulfills himself by his work. At the same time, work is a social dimension through its intimate relationship not only to the family, but also to the common good, since it may truly be said that it is only by the labor of working people that states grow rich." So there's vocation to work. Let's get back to the book of Genesis. Before the fall, God gave this command to live in the image of God, the Creator, by sharing in the gift of procreation, by sharing in the gift of a twofold other type of work, subduing the earth and having dominion over all living creatures. We've all received this vocation to cooperate, to co-work with the Creator. In subduing the earth, God created for us, and in having dominion over other creatures. We are the image of God partly through this mandate. In carrying it out, every human being reflects to some degree the very action of the Creator of the universe. This type of work distinguishes him from creatures. What's that subdue all about? We're able to make computers from sand. We're able to make medicines from amoeba. This is what the Lord, he's built in, what St. Augustine said, seminal reason, seeds for future growth that we've got to harness. After the fall, when sin invaded our experience, this vocational work remained, but now would be accomplished differently. With the sweat of your brow, with the pangs of childbirth. But this toil became part of the redemption. Sweat and toil, which work necessarily involves, since the fall, present the Christian and everyone else called to follow Christ with the possibility of sharing lovingly in the work that Christ came to do. By enduring the toil of work in union with Christ crucified, the human person collaborates with the Son of God for the redemption of humanity. Pangs of childbirth. A mother loves her child so much to go through them, more than once often. Parents love their children enough to go through the heavy toil of work, and so much sweat on the brow and under the armpits and in every other body part. This is all meant, in a sense, to spit out the effects of sin and selfishness and conform us ever more in love to the one who came and did so much work for us. Work transforms both the worker and the world. And we need to focus on both dimensions of human labor. Pope Benedict, in Caritas in Veritate, introduces us to these two dimensions of work. He says, "Technology enables us to exercise dominion over matter, to reduce risk, to save labor, to improve the conditions of life. It touches the heart of the vocation of human work. In technology, seen as the product of his genius, man recognizes himself and forges his own humanity. Technology is the objective side of human action, whose origin and raison d'etre is found in the subjective element, who is the worker himself. For this reason, technology can never be merely technology. It reveals man and his aspirations toward development. It expresses the inner tension that impels him gradually to overcome material limitations. Technology, in this sense, is a response to God's command to till and keep the land. This command that he's entrusted to humanity must serve to reinforce the covenant between human beings and the environment, a covenant that should mirror God's own creative love." There's an objective and a subjective dimension of work, and we need to ponder both. St. John Paul II used different terminology. He used the terminology transitive and intransitive. He says, first, work is a transitive activity that changes creation. Man dominates the earth by the very fact of domesticating animals, rearing them, obtaining them from them the food and clothing he needs. But man subdues the earth much more when he begins to cultivate and transform its products, adapting them to his own use. The transitive function of work is to make something. The intransitive dimension of work is to form someone. Work honestly done transforms the worker. As a person, man is a subject of work. And independent of it work's objective content, his actions serve to realize his humanity. This conditions the very ethical nature of work, involving a subject who decides about himself through freedom and virtue. The dignity of work is sought to primarily in the subjective dimension, not the objective one. This means that workers can never be human resources or human capital. I'd like to highlight the point in two ways, which I have up there. In Latin, there are two words to do. First is facere, second is agere. And this translates into other languages, fare in agere in Italian, hacer in actuar in Spanish, fazer e agir in Portuguese, fer e actuar, I think, likewise in French. Facere means to make something, like the sandboat. Agire is what happens to me when I build this well. If I build something shoddy that's going to fall the next time somebody speaks at it, I am building myself shoddily as I do. But when I make it well for the service of another, I am building myself up. That's the intransitive notion of work. St. Gregory of Nyssa in the 4th century, he said that by our work, we are our own parents. That we make ourselves by the type of work we do, by the choices we make. We're making honest decisions. If we're really putting 100% into what we're doing, we are forming our character. But likewise, if we're dishonest, if we're cheating, if we're going in and we're just surfing the web all day when we're supposed to be doing work, we're getting paid for work that we're really not even doing, we're impacting ourselves. And one of the biggest shifts from going as a priest in Fall River, Massachusetts, to working in New York was when I gave my first talk on the dignity of work to New Yorkers. I gave a little bit different, but normally what I would give in other contexts. And at the end, they almost wanted to lynch me because I didn't talk about workaholism. I didn't talk about working too hard. Their reality is that a lot of them just are addicted to work or what work will provide. Eventually, decades down the road, a C-level position where they're going to be able to take it a little bit more easily. When I was a pastor in inner city Fall River, Massachusetts, I had to preach routinely about the sinfulness of collecting when you're not injured, collecting social services. Or just thinking that if you hurt your back a little bit when you're 40, that means you're retired for the rest of your life and God's not asking you to do any other type of work that doesn't involve your back. I had a 22-year-old kid come in who had cut his finger working at Walmart, and he was being persuaded by his father and his grandfather that he would probably be able to get 99 weeks of unemployment. When we approach work that way, we're not going to be creating ourselves, cooperating with God in a way that's ultimately geared towards sanctity. That's why unemployment's such a big deal. That's why, for example, Pope Francis is always talking about unemployment, especially for young people. That one of the biggest social problems that the world faces is unemployment for young people. If they can't get a job, they're going to start to learn some other habits. And it's not going to be leading to the perfection of the human nature and the vocation that God has given them. The emphasis on the humanity of workers gives rise to a Catholic and, I think, Christian conception of the business enterprise that is radically different from a conception of an enterprise as a mere engine of profits. The purpose of a business firm within a Catholic perspective is not just to make money, but to form a communion of persons that can satisfy their basic needs through work and contribute to the well-being of society. All this leads to what John Paul II calls the gospel of work. In work, man ought to imitate his creator in working and in resting, because man alone has this unique characteristic of God's likeness. Man participates in the very activity of God himself. Jesus didn't just proclaim the gospel of work with his lips, but with his life. He became a technon, a construction worker, just like his foster father Joseph. The books of the Old Testament contain many references to human work. The doctor, the pharmacist, the craftsman, the artist, the blacksmith, the potter, farmer, scholar, sailor, builder, musician, shepherd, fisherman. Jesus, when he came, used most of those in his parables. He used farmers and fishermen to describe the work of the kingdom. John Paul II argued that businesses make a contribution to the community by fostering the special dignity of human work. Just like business, employment is a noble and essential vocation. But businesses need to subordinate profits to this human reality. Which doesn't mean forget about profits, but to just not make profits the sole means of why one runs a business. Let's get to the specific vocation of the entrepreneur. This phrase doesn't refer, as I mentioned before, just to those who found startup companies, but to those who have responsibility for the creation of wealth, for its growth in business. The theology of the business vocation, like any vocational theology, needs to provide a vision that identifies the deeper meaning of what someone is doing so that he can begin to see the sacred and its potential realization in day-to-day work life. What would be the elements of the vocation of an entrepreneur? The then Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, now it's the Dicastery for Promoting Human Integral Human Development in the Vatican, put out in 2012 a beautiful reflection called The Vocation of the Business Leader. And it said that entrepreneurship is a vocation of holiness marked by five things. First, acceptance of risk. Jesus is constantly telling us, be not afraid and put out into the deep. Entrepreneurs do. Persistence in the offering of beneficial goods and services to others. Creative planning to combine the resources of oneself with others. Adaptation in the face of initial failures. They don't give up. Pursuing this vocation, the entrepreneur at his or her best embarks on a life that involves a certain surrender of control, as well as the surrender of all that's provisional and unnecessary. St. Bernardine of Siena in the 1400s, at a time when the mercantile class was growing, recognized four gifts in the entrepreneur. Efficiency, responsibility, that they take responsibility for others, hard work, and risk-taking. He said that the entrepreneur takes these gifts and combines them with insight about something people need, works very hard to fill this need in a creative and productive way. In the process, he employs the labor of others, giving them a means to support their families. In the end, he's created wealth and prosperity that didn't exist before. Entrepreneurs share in a particular way in the work of the Creator to bring out the fullest potential to everything that God has given. He said that the image of God can be seen in the way entrepreneurs combine mind, material, and work, mind, material, and work, to provide products and services that contribute to human flourishing. Business enterprise is therefore not a generator of profits alone, but contributes to human dignity, forms community, and provides worthwhile goods and services. Business leaders have a special role to play in the unfolding of creation by helping to shape and steward productive organizations that can extend the work of unfolding into the future. Some of the marks of the entrepreneurial vocation. First is participation in God's own creative work. Second, seeing ahead, participating in God's providence, to envision the possibility of an innovative good or service, to appreciate its benefits and plan the appropriate combination of resources needed to produce that product or service. The entrepreneur shows a providential care, anticipating the needs of others, and takes risks based on what he or she thinks will be the other's response. The entrepreneur intends to create part of the future, but at the same time recognizes that success or failure will be determined by others who are free to accept or reject the offer made by the entrepreneur. The entrepreneurial response to this dependency on the free decisions of others is not to draw back and conserve wealth, but rather to persist with a willingness to change, trusting that the world is or eventually will be open to the creative change offered by the entrepreneur. Third thing we see is entrepreneurs are called to be good stewards of the earth, of themselves and of other people, as part of the talents entrusted to them by God. In a stewardship approach, leaders balance optimizing returns today with the need to avoid potentially catastrophic outcomes to ensure the business exists in 50 or 100 years. The failure of this type of stewardship approach is what led to modern financial crises, to environmental damage, etc. One business objective is good wealth, which means generating sustainable wealth and distributing it justly. Fourth, business people are innovative servants. They serve others. To be successful, they have to focus acutely, even obsessively, on the needs of others. Give the public what it needs and legitimately wants, and even discover needs and wants so subtle that they're imperceptible to most others. Jesus stresses service in his morality. If anyone wants to be the first, he must be the very last in the service of all. Entrepreneurs at their best have a burning desire to provide a service not readily available, to meet unmet or poorly met needs. The business leader is not a speculator in that sense Pope Francis was decrying, but essentially an innovator. Speculator looks at building roads or establishing hospitals or schools, for example, as a means to the maximization of profit. Business serves the common good by creating goods that are truly good and services that truly serve. Next, the entrepreneur displays the virtue of inventiveness, imagining new possibilities. They're vigilant practitioners in the art of discovery, for by it they, as good shepherds, will create. Built into the entrepreneur is an anthropology of freedom, and a cosmos open to continuous creativity, seeing the need for new goods, new methods of production or transportation, new technologies, new markets, etc. Entrepreneurs take risks. Long before they see a return on their ideas or their investments, they give up their time or property. They pay out wages even before they know whether they have accurately forecast the future, when they still have no assurance of profit. This was compared by one theologian to Christ's kenotic love in giving before he knows even how others will respond. And lastly, entrepreneurs tutor others by example and mentorship on how to become independent and produce wealth themselves. I want to turn to some scriptural passages to talk about the virtues of those who are rich. It's not the rich which is their virtue. It's not the wealth, but it's how they use it. Zacchaeus was praised by Jesus when he said, "Look, half my possessions, Lord, I'll give to the poor. And if I've defrauded anyone of anything, I'll pay it back four times over." Joseph of Arimathea gave his tomb to Jesus. The Good Samaritan. If the Good Samaritan had been without capital, he couldn't have paid for the care of the man who was beaten and robbed on the road to Jericho. The apostles were fishermen first, four of them at least, who learned about hard work and diligence in a market setting. Was this one of the reasons why Jesus chose them in the first place? Is it one of the reasons why he chose an entrepreneur, Peter, who owned his company, to be the first among the apostles? But the most important scriptural passage in elucidating the entrepreneurial vocation is the parable of the talents, on which we'll spend most of the time that we have left. You know this passage from Matthew 25, 14 to 30. I won't read it, but let's comment on it. With regard to the material world, this is a parable about capital, investment, entrepreneurship, and the proper use of economic resources. In our Christian life and the life of the entrepreneur, there's a clear connection between entrepreneurial opportunities and the master's command to be watchful of his return and good stewards of his property. This fundamentally involves how we use the gift of the graces God has given us. The entrepreneur is one who precisely invests the talent God has given. The talent of his life, the talent of his health, education, and know-how, the talent of his work, the talent of his natural, spiritual, material gifts, the talent of the opportunities in front of him. God gives us talents to create more wealth, understood not simply in monetary terms, but in terms of developing ourselves, others, and the world. The master, with a capital M, expects his servants to seek to multiply. Rather than passively bury and preserve what they've been given, we're expected to invest what God has given. The wealth is always the master's. We're called to use it not for our kingdom, but for his. The master carefully assesses the natural abilities of each servant, but he is overwhelmingly generous to each. Sometimes we don't hear that in Matthew 25, when he gives one 5 talents, one 2, and one 1. And sometimes we can think one, oh, you could lose it. But a talent was a weight measurement. And what was a talent? It was the largest denomination of the time, equivalent to 6,000 days' wages, 16 plus years of work. So it was a huge amount. If one were making $12.50 an hour and working 8 hours a day, one talent would be worth $600,000 in today's money. So there was a lot to invest. We see in this parable that it's not immoral to profit from resources, from wit, time, and work God has given us. And the Lord gives an extraordinary reward when we are creative. Well done, good and trustworthy servant. You've been trustworthy in little things. I'll put you in charge of great things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. Those who develop the talents God has given them will grow. Just like when we exercise muscles, those muscles grow. What's the problem with the third servant in the parable? First, he was a chicken. The master was angry at the timidity of the servant who had received the one talent. He's displeased with the wasting of the talent. God commands us to use our talents toward productive ends, but he refused. In the teaching of the rabbis of the age, it was possible to hide money in the ground. Burying, in fact, was regarded as the best security against theft. In the parable, Jesus went against that cultural convention to make the point about putting God's gifts to use to encourage reasonable risk-taking, we could say. The master considered burying the talent and thus breaking even to be foolish. He called him a fool because he believed capital should earn a reasonable rate of return. The ferocity of the master's reaction to the wasting of the opportunity is noteworthy. He calls him wicked and slothful and banishes him. Apparently, it's not just the servant's sloth that solicits such wrath. He also shows no contrition, and he blamed his master for the timidity. I knew you were a harsh man. That's why I buried it. Out of fear of failure, he refused even to try to succeed. The lazy servant hypothetically may have been able to avoid his dismal fate by having been more entrepreneurial. If he had made an effort to trade with his master's money and came back with less than a talent, he likely wouldn't have been treated so harshly. For at least he would have labored on behalf of his master. The lesson may not be just about success, but better, about trying. We also see here the importance of subsidiarity, solidarity, and trust. The master allows his servants to decide themselves about how best to invest. In this regard, he gave them full liberty. He doesn't micromanage. He unleashes their gifts. This principle of subsidiarity, that you let lesser orders do what they can rather than subsuming them by higher orders. It's rooted in the conviction that as images of God, the flourishing of human beings entail the best use of their intelligence and freedom. Human dignity is never respected by unnecessarily constraining or suppressing that intelligence and freedom. That happens in so many places, both socialist places as well as, in some cases, free market situations. In a workplace, the more participatory it is, the more likely the workers will develop. They should have a voice in the work they do, especially in the work they do on a day-to-day basis, to unleash their creativity, their initiative, and a shared sense of responsibility. Employees on a lower level are trusted, trained, experienced, know precisely their responsibilities. When they're free to make decisions, they can use their freedom and intelligence, develop as people, and develop the company. They may even be perceived as co-entrepreneurs. Other lessons in the parable? The parable suggests that an unequal distribution of wealth, such as it is not unjust. For the first servant received more than the second and the third. God blesses us all abundantly, but we're not necessarily blessed all in the same way, at the same level. Makes clear that making a profit can't be equated with greed because it's a proper use of the gift. Third, the leveling of money or the reallocation of resources is not foreseen. A moral system is one that doesn't try to make everyone the same, but one that recognizes and tries to assist each person to use his talents to the fullest. We all have the responsibility to employ the faculties with which we've been endowed rather than lament those things we don't have. And the parable also tells us something about macroeconomics. At the beginning, 8 talents were given. Upon his return, those 8 had become 15. The parable is not the story of a zero-sum gain. One person's gain was not at the other's expense. The successful trading of the first servant didn't hinder the prospects for the third servant. So it's true of a genuine free market economy. The success of the rich doesn't have to come at the expense of the poor. If by becoming rich the most successful servant had hurt others, the master in the parable would not have praised him. Let's finish with practical considerations on living the entrepreneurial vocation well. Entrepreneurs are called to sanctity in business, to be good stewards of the master. If vocation in the Christian context is a call to holiness, then intrinsic to any vocation is a call to moral integrity. The vocation of entrepreneurs, therefore, is falsified when entrepreneurs deceive or cheat others and violate the bonds of trust with their associates and constituency. They need guiding principles. They need virtuous leadership. They can't create conditions where expediency overcomes justice, where power corrupts wisdom, where technical instruments are detached from human dignity, where self-interest marginalizes the common good. Second, entrepreneurs must depend on God, receiving his gifts and responding to them. The work of an entrepreneur first is receptive before it's creative. The talents, the resources, the opportunities that have been given. The first act that God calls from business leaders is to receive him, to receive the scriptures, to receive the sacraments, to honor the Sabbath, to pray, etc. with a lot of what we do. For man it is impossible all by himself, but not for God. God makes possible so much of what's achieved. Third, entrepreneurs must beware of all greed. The love of money, not money. The love of money is the root of all evil. Greed is an excessive or insatiable desire for material gain. Regardless of one's present economic status, whether one's rich or one's poor, the desire is excessive when in the depths of a person's being it outweighs moral and spiritual concerns. When profitability is the first indicator of organizational health, it is neither the only one nor the most important measure by which business should be judged. Next, entrepreneurs must strive to maintain a unity of life, to keep their moral integrity at work and outside. There's no big split between faith and life, between public and private. Today, one of the biggest struggles is a divided life, the split between the faith we profess and the way we live our daily life. Dividing the demands of one's faith from one's work and business is a fundamental error that contributes to much of the damage we see some businesses do in our world today. Overcoming the importance of family and spiritual life, etc. So many of the anger of women today is when our culture forces them to choose fully between being moms and working out their own entrepreneurial vocation without creatively finding means by which it can be a both and for their betterment and the betterment of society. Christians must remain mindful of the words of Jesus that no one can serve two masters. We'll either hate one and love the other, or be attached to one and despise the other. That we can't love both God and money. Rather than divided, we're called toward integrated lives, fully ordered, not disordered, living up to God's call. Next, entrepreneurs must strive to build a community of persons. The purpose of business is not just to make a profit, but is found in the very existence as a community of persons, John Paul II said, who in various ways are endeavoring to satisfy their basic needs and form a particular group at the service of the whole of society. You know, one of the things that we do with sex trafficking victims, and I've done a lot of work there at the UN and out the outside, is sometimes because they were trafficked when they were just teenagers, they know of nothing else they can do. And we've got to give them in community something that they can do together. Whether it's knitting, whether it's cooking, whatever it is, some type of community activity so that they can overcome the history of exploitation and begin to build something together, allowing the creativity of each and the work of each to redound to the good of all. Entrepreneurs must seek true solidarity with the poor. One can't be a good steward without feeling connected. We need to care, to allow ourselves to be affected by others so that our priorities and path change. Good parents know this when their children come. Good business people, likewise, need to maintain this type of solidarity. The entrepreneur is called to be charitable in his work and as a result of his work. He's called to give in a way that responds to what he has received. The self-gift of the person inquires not so much how far it must go, but how far it may go. It's not just giving something, but giving truly generously, giving in accordance with what one has received. Entrepreneurs must not facilitate the metastasis of consumerism through the way that we run corporations and things like that. It's not just creating needs to make people hunger. This is what happens with so many of the businesses involved in the $150 billion a year toxic dump called pornography. Entrepreneurs must properly value rest and take it, is the last point. God rested on the seventh day. Not only do business people need to avoid becoming slaves to their work, the third commandment is the only one which God told us why. Remember to keep holy the Lord's day, and it sounds like a non sequitur, but it isn't. because you were once slaves in Egypt. When we're not keeping Holy the Lord's Day, we're a slave to something. A lot of times we can be a slave to work and to what work produces. We can't be a slave. And likewise, those who have companies need to allow their people, almost insist on time off, because they're not just workhorses. They likewise have souls. And there's a particular sacramental dimension to that Sabbath day, to go so that God can press the reset button on our existence. The then Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace Vocation of the Business Leader beautifully concludes, "The vocation of the business person is a genuine human and Christian calling. Its importance in the life of the church and in the world economy can hardly be overstated." Pope Benedict wrote in Caritas in Veritate that a vocation is a call that requires a free and responsible answer. Its response first to being chosen by God. It wasn't I who chose you. It wasn't you who chose me. It was I who chose you and appointed you to go and bear fruit that will last. And he said, precisely because God gives a resounding yes to the human person, we can't fail to open ourselves to the divine vocation to pursue our own God-given development. In the Gospel, Jesus tells us, from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. From the one who has been entrusted with more, even more will be asked. Business people have been given great resources, and the Lord asks them to do great things. This is the vocation of the entrepreneur, to whom God has given great talents for the building up of his kingdom, to whom he gives his help in order to develop them as sons and daughters of the kingdom. Thanks very much for your attention. We have, I think, about 20, 25 minutes for your questions.